Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and we're back for, I think it's episode 4 of The Final Word, where once again we have a wonderful guest who will without doubt regale us with tales of glory and tales of mayhem and tales of violence and tales of being there. I'm pretty sure he usually manages to anyway. Before we do that, usual co-hosts for this and co-pilots. First of all, series founder and architect is now the new word I'm using, Gary, the architect of this series, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, buddy. I've been called a lot worse than architect, mate. That's for sure. When I set the this series up and invited guys to come forward, you know, I was delighted, massively delighted that this final was chosen. Because as a Chelsea fan, I was born 1 year after Chelsea won the league and had to wait until 1970 for us to win a real trophy. And in honour of this game, I've got my Chelsea replica kit on from 1970 FA Cup on the Peter Osgood shirt, and there's my badge. So I'm looking forward to this one, matey.
It is a replica and not an original.
I did speak to Ozzy, but, you know, he said no. It's worth thousands, and I love you guys, but not by that much.
Like I say, we're on episode 4 now, and it took us a while to get to the football with these finals. And there's a bit of football to chat about in this one, and probably a little bit of other stuff, shall we say, to chat about.
Yeah, ahead of the game, there's a little bit of Horse of the Year show that has an influence on the pitch at Wembley. But we're talking about the replay in this game. But, we'll touch on it. I'm sure you were touching the Wembley final as well. But the main focus is on the replay at Old Trafford. And football occasionally broke out.
It was played in parts. Yeah. And our second guest is normally Mr. Stephen Scragg, but at time of recording, Liverpool are playing Tottenham, so he made out he was busy. I don't know doing what, but he made out he was. But that doesn't matter, because we've got the equally able and capable Mr. Aidan Williams. Aidan, welcome to The Final Word.
Oh, thank you very much, Stu. I am very much looking forward to this one. So I was very pleased to get the call, because what a game this was.
It is, and like you said, I mean, you know, this is, we've done a couple where it was, certainly the first two was everything but the football. Then we've had an episode where it is all about the football, and then now we're sort of, like Gary said there, we're undecided. There is patches of it here and there if you look closely enough in the game.
There are patches of it. Well, there's a lot of patches in the field as well, you know. Patches is what we're talking about here, but... it's such an iconic game, regardless of what went on in it, which I'm sure we'll delve into in some detail. But, you know, the sort of glamour against the dour perception, you know, that reality is somewhat different. I'm sure we'll get into all of that. But, you know, that's the sort of narrative of it and the way it's been looked at through the years. And iconic match.
It is. And superb. What frightened me when I was doing a little bit of sort of reading and research for this game is half a century old.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like there's a pregnant pause there. I feel like destroyed the ambience. Sorry, Gary. Destroyed the ambience of the whole podcast. Yeah. Well, but yeah, it's 50 years old, this game. And as Aidan just said, it is incredibly iconic. And with that, we'll move across to our iconic special guest. There you go. You can have that one for free. Our iconic special guest, like I say, who just has a story for every occasion. And I have no doubt that this will be any different. So, as we say, to discuss the 1970 FA Cup final replay between Leeds United and Gary's Chelsea, Mr. Paul McParlan. Paul, welcome.
Sure, thanks for that lovely build-up. That's putting pressure on me right from the start there. And I was mega impressed there about Gary having met Peter Osgood. I was just wondering, did he ever introduce you to Racco Walsh, or can you not talk about that on the radio?
I would never divorce my sources. Never. The nearest I've come to meeting people, I was going to standing beneath the statue and sort of stroking it with reverence, but I'm never right, obviously. But I'm honoured to wear the number 9 that he wore at Wembley.
Indeed. It's an iconic shirt, and for the architect, Hugh Stewart's word behind this iconic series.
Yeah, bless you, mate. It's a small thing before we sort of start. There's a real strange thing about the Wembley final against the at Old Trafford. And it's Wembley. Chelsea wore all blue and white socks, and Leeds wore all white with red socks. In the replay, Leeds wore all white with white socks, and Chelsea wore blue with a yellow trim, they've worn a couple of times in sort of because the 50th year anniversary in this FA Cup, in the FA Cup tournament. And I love that shirt with the blue and yellow. It works so well. Great days.
It's I feel like we've just finished the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like yesterday, Gary. Just by much of
So obviously, Paul, when Gary sort of came with the idea of the series, it was thrown open. Any football final you want, any competition, anywhere in the world, any time in history. There's only 3 gone so far. Four gone so far. So we've arrived at the sort of the 1970 replay. So of all finals, why this one?
All right. I think I'd take an hour just telling you why this one, but if we just go through some facts. First, I think it's the only FA Cup final to be played in April since the competition was moved to Wembley. It was the first FA Cup final that was won on a league ground since Wembley was first established. It was the second most viewed sporting event on British TV with an audience of 28 million, only surpassed by the World Cup final. So that kind of gives you an idea of how enraptured the country was by that final. In fact, at a time when there were only 3 terrestrial channels, BBC One, BBC Two and ITV, the same evening Manchester City were playing Górnik Zabrze in the final of the European Cup Winners' Cup, and that wasn't covered on TV. So for Man City fans, have always been quite annoyed by the fact that their European victory wasn't shown live on British TV, which is really, really unusual. I think Gary alluded there at the start, it brought together two teams with a certain degree of antipathy towards each other. It brought the team that had finished second against the team that had finished third. And I think that was the first time that had happened since 1962. So it was two of the top teams in the country. There were only 2 points apart in terms of the league placings. They'd already met 4 times that year. They'd met each other in the League Cup, which went to a replay. So you kind of had the taste one might be coming there. Leeds had won both the 2 league games. So Leeds were strong favourites going into the match as well. Neither side had won the FA Cup before as well, so that added a level of interest to us as well. And it was just this idea of bringing together certain stereotypes that were floating around about both clubs at the time. So it was almost like the dour, dirty Northerners from Leeds against the sophisticated Southerners from the King's Road area of Chelsea. And an idea of the contrast would be that there was this image that the Chelsea team were full of playboys, and even like Tommy Baldwin and John Boyle, who weren't exactly blessed in the looks department, but were going out with a member of the Pants People, and with the infamous Fiona Richmond, who Malcolm Anderson had a bit of a dalliance with a few years later as well. So even the less glamorous people in the Chelsea side appear to be doing quite well for themselves with the celebrity model stakes. Leeds, by comparison, were the city of the good old days music hall show. The ground was situated in a very run-down area of Leeds. They were still washing, hanging out on the street lines, and holding the beast as you walk towards the ground. Whereas Chelsea oozed sophistication, King's Road glamour. Film stars would quite often be seen watching the Chelsea games. Even northern film stars and actors like Rodney Buse and people started supporting Chelsea rather than their local northern clubs because they just thought that's more the place to be. On the other hand, Leeds was the town of Jimmy Savile. Leeds celebrity plus was Ronnie Hilton. So just in terms of how the two teams were perceived, there was a massive difference. Then again, how they perceived wasn't actually the truth, because Chelsea had hard men in their side. Any side that feels a player called Chopper Harris isn't going to be a total footballing side. Eddie McCready was one of the most silenced assassins in British football at the time. And he'd already done Johnny Giles in the league game at Stamford Bridge, and Giles would return to his own back in the FA Cup final. And Leeds weren't exactly a team of saints either. You know, you had like Gary Sprigg, who was a notorious womaniser, Jack Charlton, who preferred to spend his evenings in a club in Leeds rather than playing carpet bowls. So the stereotypes didn't fit all the players. And even the Chelsea side, they had quite a few very straight-laced players. You had Peter Housman, the clean-cut boy next door, Peter Bonetti, who was hardly a big socialiser, John Holland, who wasn't sort of down the King's Road every night. So within those images, there were certain subtexts as well. So it was the most fascinating clash of styles and concepts that you could have brought to an FA Cup final. And then add to that, it was the first FA Cup final to go to a replay since 1912, since Barnsley beat West Brom, I think, 1-0. It was the longest ever domestic FA Cup final because the replay meant extra time as well. So, you know, it says it's ticking every box for an iconic, unique final. This final had and still has everything. There'd never been a final like it before. There will never be a final like it again. And in terms of, you know, the actual occasion itself, the match itself, it was one of the most, despite the way it's judged now, at the time, it wasn't judged that way, and it was one of the most iconic and entertaining finals for all sorts of different reasons that I've had the privilege to watch.
Yeah, but why did you pick it?
I know.
Aidan, there's so much to unpick from that. But certainly one of the things that struck me that that I didn't realise until Paul had gone through it there, it's 1970, and obviously we know that lead side of Don Revie and the sort of the glamour of Chelsea and what's going on. I didn't realise that neither side had won the FA Cup leading up to that point.
No, yeah, neither side had won it. That's true. And Leeds had been beaten by Chelsea in the semi-final in 1967 as well. So a bit of embittered from that, I imagine, coming into this. This season also, Leeds had narrowly missed out on other trophies. You know, obviously, Paul's mentioned they were very close to in the league race, but they also got to the semi-finals of the European competition as well, losing out to Celtic, I think. And so, you know, near misses is something that Leeds were certainly familiar with in this era. And obviously, Chelsea hadn't won the FA Cup; they'd got to the final and so on, but not managed to get that far. So, yeah, something had to give for one of them. Maybe this is why it took so long, two games and two lots of extra time, because, you know, neither of them knew how to finish the job off. I don't know.
And again, you know, as you know, Paul's given us a great introduction there, Gary, and, you know, all this stuff. And obviously you're a slightly biased Chelsea fan in this discussion. But, you know, Paul, at the end, as he was chatting there, you know, talks about it being an iconic game. And I think, You know, for me, although it's only 1970, and obviously it sort of, you know, cuts across two decades, but to me, when people sort of mention football of the late 60s, early 70s, that's the game. You know, for me, that's the game that sums up probably that period, probably just past the World Cup final, right up until sort of Liverpool start dominating Europe. Those sort of 66-67, right up to 77, that period there, this game, the players, the team, the moments, the North-South divide, you know, all of those things, the pitch, the state of the pitch, the war of attrition, the great goals, the flair players, the heart, to me, it just sums up almost a decade of football in 120 minutes.
Didn't it just? And there's plenty of antipathy between the two clubs, and you know, there might be a mutual respect, but there was certainly no mutual like between the two clubs. And, you know, it's interesting to see Paul say about, you know, Chelsea players who were, you know, going to clubs with the likes of Fiona Richmond and the Pants People on their arm, and, you know, Leeds United players were going to drive with the likes of Nora Batty and Ina Sharp or something like that. You know, and, I mean, you know, Chelsea were painted as the softies, as, you know, Leeds were going to be the sort of, you know, more determined, more manly team. And, you know, as Paul quite rightly says, the team that included Chopper Harris in their team ain't going to be tolerated in the Southern softies tagged for very long. And the first game at Wembley was a strange game. The Horse of the Year show had been held there a week or so before, and as Paul said, the farming board forward because of the World Cup and to give England chances of going to defend the title. And, you know, a 2-2 draw at Wembley set up the replay at Old Trafford magnificently well. And it was an epic game,
I think as well, Gary. I know there's antipathy between the sides, but there's also a fair bit of antipathy between the supporters as well. And Stu, Stu, you touched upon the culture thing there. Now, I mean, it's just not a sign of the history lesson, but it was a big thing in the late 60s and early 70s. If you were part of an away support, that you would try to take the home end. So you would turn up en masse on the home fans' terraces. And then you go straight to the centre of the terrace. You get in there as soon as the terrace hour's over, and you defend the bit of terrace pattern that you'd stolen. Infamously, in the 69-70 season, the Shed Boys went onto the Gelded End in Leeds and occupied the middle until about 2 o'clock, when on both sides of the terraces, hordes of Leeds fans came across, charged the Chelsea fans, and then shoved them out to the Gelded End. So it says, antipathy. I mean, Leeds fans are outraged that Chelsea had the nerve to try and take their home end with a relatively, you know, with a comparatively small contingent of fans. So the fan culture at the time then certainly was, if you're an away supporter and you could take the opposition end, that was bragging rights. You go to work or school on Monday and talk about how you'd taken the opposition end. And it was a real big thing at the time. That just added to the antipathy between both sets of fans as well. So not only did the players not get on, neither did the fans get on with each other as well, particularly.
It's, I mean, like I say, it's, you know, to me, culture and sort of especially fan culture, you know, all of these things, you know, absolutely fascinate me. And like you say, Paul, I guess that's, you know, not only does it timestamp the game as you watch it, you know, as played out on the pitch between 22 players, but it almost it's a timestamp of its time and everything associated. You know, you talk about the North still, you know, washing, hanging out the terraced houses, you know, and all of that is still associated. You know, in London, it's the King's Road. It's very glamorous. It's, you know, and you're right. And while we mentioned it was 50 years ago and, you know, there's a sharp intake of breath, but yet, if you think of it as a 1970, you think of it as a relatively modern final, but it is very much time-stamped in terms of its culture and associated culture that goes with it. And part of that's the television channels, you know, not showing two different live games at the same time would be, I would imagine, horrendous to think about. You know, it's sort of in 1970. But in terms of the route there then, Paul, you know, we have this final, you know, and Gary's mentioned there that, you know, the final sort of blighted by what was allowed to play out on the Wembley pitch a week or so before. But in terms of sort of from third round to final, just a little bit about the route to this infamous meeting at Old Trafford.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've asked you some visual aids here as well. So in the third rounds, Chelsea played Birmingham City, programme there. Chelsea beat them 3-0, I think. Chelsea beat them 3-0, I think it was, to go through. In the fourth round, Chelsea played Burnley. And can I just read you something from the programme, which is goes back to the culture and of its times references that you mentioned, Stu? So, in the front cover short part of the programme, two paragraphs down, I'll read this to you now. Holiday time. Here's a new line in the many and varied activities, business activities of the Chelsea footballers. John Boyle and Tommy Baldwin have bought a luxury flat in Alicante in Spain, and it will become available for holiday fans and Chelsea visitors to rent from the 1st of May. It's a situation 5 minutes from the beach with a swimming pool nearby and 3 bedrooms to sleep 6. John and Tommy can arrange flights and transport to and from Alicante airports. And if you're interested in staying at their place, write to Chelsea FC for further details. Now, can you imagine any Premier League footballer now putting in a matchday programme? I've got a holiday apartment. We'll pick up at the airport and we'll take it to stay in the accommodation.
Oh, let me just say, that's about half an hour down the road from me. So I've still got the place.
You're there. But the fact that's in the matchday programme, you know, and all you have to do is write to the club. I mean, it just shows the time, this kind of second homes, you know, for footballs was just maybe starting to be a thing there. But I could give a straight face for that one. I actually went to the replay at Burnley because I think I mentioned in a previous article of these football times, one of my best friends at school at the time, Rob Conroy, massive Chelsea fan, and occasionally he'd say to me, do you want to come along and watch this game, Paul? And it was a Tuesday night, I had nothing better to do. was a 7:30 kickoff at Turf Moor. We both bumped off school in the afternoon. We messed up the bus stop. We got to Burnley by a very tortuous journey. It was Burnley's biggest gate for years. We just about managed to get in before they closed the gates. An unsung hero of that Chelsea Cup campaign, Peter Housman, probably his best ever game in a Chelsea shirt, pulled them back when they were losing 1-0, scored two brilliant goals. The match went to extra time. We actually missed the final goal because we had to try and get a bus back to Liverpool by various different means. We didn't. It's a long story how we got back, but it was a journey to remember. And that was the only time in the FA Cup run that Chelsea played outside of London, because every other tie brought them against a London team. So they played at home against Birmingham, home against Burnley, away against Crystal Palace, away against QPR, and then the semi-final. Now, in the semi-final draw, you had Leeds, Man United, Watford. Everyone wanted Watford. Chelsea got Watford in the semi-final draw, because Watford were their courtesy of their fabulous 1-0 win over Liverpool in the quarter-final as well. Anyway, that's a different story. But Leeds also had a very, very kind of a straightforward route to the final as well. So they'd come across the likes of Swindon Town, Sutton United, Mansfield Town, and all had gone well in terms of their FA Cup draws, until they got to the semi-final when they drew Manchester United. Now, I think at the time, in terms of planning a strategy for the season, I just assumed the semi-final would just take one game. Now, if you reflect back to 64-65, when the two sides met in the semi-final then, it went to a replay and extra time as well. So he kind of underestimated what a close tie that was going to be. So first game was a draw after extra time. Second game was a draw after extra time. And then the third game, Leeds won 1-0, courtesy of Billy Bremner. But you cannot underestimate how much those three games took out to Leeds United in terms of their chance for the league, chance for the European Cup, and the chance for the FA Cup as well. So I think both sides had a relatively easy passage to the FA Cup final. On the way there, they suffered a couple of blows. Alan Hudson broke his leg, I think, a few weeks before the FA Cup final. And at the time, Alan Hudson at 18, you know, as a teenage lad, you wanted to be Alan Hudson. He was the local lad who'd made it good with his local team. He had the looks, he had the style, he had the glamour. He's just everything you wanted to be. And Leeds United lost their key defender, Paul Reaney, who broke his leg against West Ham, because the Football League insisted they fulfilled a league fixture 24 hours after the European Cup semi-final first leg against Celtic. So both sides were missing key players for the final as well. And always interesting to speculate, if Hudson had played in that final, I don't think it would have gone to replay. I think I'd have fancied Chelsea strongly to win the first game at Wembley, but that's just a personal opinion. But yeah, basically, both sides had relatively easy passages to get there. And it was quite fortunate, you know, that the team that finished second or third in the Football League that season were going to meet the final. It just captured, it's the North East South, it's second v third, it's, you know, stereotypes clashing with each other, and different managerial styles as well. Don Revie, who's got, you know, the dour Carver Bowles guy. Steve Sector, who's also quite dour, but had kind of a different image to Don Revie in terms of being a bit more outgoing, a bit less superstitious. And the main difference being Chelsea were viewed as the footballing glamour side. Leeds were the dour ones who ground out results.
It's, you know, I mean, the FA Cup final replays in general, Aidan. You know, we Paul sort of talked us through, you know, what it was, you know, got to be quite an arduous end to this journey to Wembley. Obviously, the final goes to a replay, you know, and it produces this absolute classic. You know, if you think about the 99 FA Cup semi-final replay with Arsenal and Manchester United, that last ever replay that they win on the treble. Where do you sit with the, I know it's slightly off topic, but obviously we're talking about a replay. We're talking about as a finals replay. Where do you sit on replays, and are they things that maybe should just be reserved for finals? Should they be brought back, or do we do well to go straight to penalties now?
I think the game has changed a lot since those days, hasn't it? And
yeah,
in many ways, not always for the better. I think cup replays, I don't see it as a feasible thing anymore, given the workload, the schedule, and the sort of higher pace and intensity of games these days. Athletes are rather more finely tuned than they were back in 1970, that's for sure. What Paul didn't mention about those semi-final replays, I guess, is that the first two were both scoreless, so it wasn't all fabulous. But, you know, it's a more satisfying way to conclude a tie, that is for sure. Penalty shootouts, whether at the end of a replay, as we've had in recent years, or whether at the end of a single game, as it is the case now, it's a disappointing way to... I think it's even worse when it comes to, say, a semi-final and a final. It's unsatisfactory in many ways. For those involved, I guess it's just as thrilling. I mean, I'm sure Gary wouldn't exchange how Chelsea's Champions League victory happened. you'd rather not have had a replay in that one, I'm quite sure. But, you know, for those watching on, it's slightly unsatisfactory for it to be decided in that way. I wouldn't use the word lottery because it's far from it. There's so much more to it, the penalty shootout, than that. But it's not a full game. It's not quite the same thing. But replays... It is something that harks back from the past now. I mean, I remember Newcastle had one with Watford. You mentioned Watford previously. We had one there that went about four replays in the 80s or something like that. And it could just grind on and on. And the impact it can have on everything else that team is involved in is just too big. And you just couldn't have it anymore. That said, though, it's a great thing to look back on. I think it adds to the sort of historical luster of events that we're talking about in the past, particularly events like this one. You know, that's not to say all finals that went to replays were good, because they weren't. This one certainly was. But it just adds to the mystique of the past, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, of the FA Cup. It's something that was glorious about it in the past, but it was of its time. I don't see that could ever come back, and it won't. That's for sure. But it definitely adds to the luster, the mystique of how it used to be. In your mind's eye, when you see a cup replay, you think of muddy pitches. You think of players going down left, right and centre with cramp because they're playing in the league the next day or the day before or whatever it is. And in those days, that's just what people did. They got on with it. Each team had 11 or 12 players and they just played and played and played and played. And that's how it went. It's a different world, but, you know, it's a great thing to look back on. And it's a sort of gives you a warm glow.
It's one of those things we like the idea of, but clearly is completely impractical.
Sadly so, but it's great on to look back on, exactly. And for games like this, great way for it to play out and to finally reach its conclusion.
For you, Gary, just something that, again, that Paul sort of touched on, that sometimes, I mean, like I said, we've had four of these and only two of them have really been about the football, and that's the managers. Obviously, Revy and Dave Sexton, in terms of Leeds and Chelsea, were they sides that played in the image of their manager? I suppose is my first question. And then my second question is, you know, how much influence and bearing did they have? You know, we're talking, the maths isn't very good. There's a lot of minutes in this final. As Paul said, it was the longest FA Cup final tie. So let's just say there's a lot of minutes. You know, how much bearing did they have over the course of these two games?
That's a great question. That's not a great question. That's two great questions. I think both managers were sort of visionaries in their own way. Revy had gone to Leeds as a bang ordinary second division team and revitalised them in his own way. Sexton was probably more of a coach than a manager. And his sort of brief tenure at Chelsea and his failure with other clubs probably reflects the fact that he was a better coach than a manager. Leeds were a team that dominated the opposition. They sort of almost strangled to death. Chelsea were different in as much as they were, you know, if here's a metaphor for you. If there were snakes, Leeds were a constrictor. Chelsea were a poison snake that would strike quickly. Rather than sort of slow and the boring death of strangulation. I mean, that's I don't mean that to be a criticism of Leeds, but they just throttle people to death because they were just they were a pressing team. They dominated teams and they just ground them down. Whereas Chelsea were more of a sort of a more dynamic team, shall we say? So if that reflects the coaches, and perhaps it does to a certain extent, and reflects the play, it probably also reflects the perception of the clubs that fans of the era will probably have them. I don't know if that answers the question. I hope it does.
Yeah, I can go with that. That works for me. Well answered, well recovered.
Reptilian metaphors will always get you out of trouble.
Always, and I do like the metaphor. I like that. We'll call one a viper and one a boa constrictor. I was trying to go through my snake from my biology lessons. Yeah. Now I'm going to ask the question, Paul, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to know the answer. So, did you go to this game we're talking about?
Yes, I did. As it happened, I mentioned my mate Rob Conroy, a massive Chelsea fan, and my dad had always gone to all the Wembley finals in the 60s with him and his mates. Made a weekend of it in London. I probably don't want to know what went on there, but they enjoyed. They looked forward to it all year, and they always seemed to get tickets for finals. So when it came to the replay, he couldn't go because he had work early the next morning. So I said, "Dad, any chance you get us any tickets?" So he made a couple of phone calls. I came up from school. There were two tickets for the replay waiting for me by my bedside table. Brilliant. Thank you, Dad. So met Rob at Lime Street Station after school. Got out of our school uniform, put on a more appropriate football gear, you know, Doc Martens, braces, Ben Shermans. No, I'm joking. and then we got the train from Lime Street to Manchester Oxford Road Station, I think, and then train from Oxford Road Station to Manchester United's ground station, which is still operates on match days as well. And I think alongside Hull City, Man United were the only teams to have a train station next to the grounds. It used to be more by Bury Park. So we got off there, and then we had a walk around outside the ground. One thing that really struck me first off was, despite the replay being in Manchester, which you would have thought would have favoured Leeds United in terms of support, in terms of distance, it almost seemed to me like there were three Chelsea fans at every two Leeds United fans. It just seemed to be Chelsea fans everywhere around the ground. Now, the Wednesday prize, the week before, Leeds had lost their FA Cup semi-final against Celtic, so everything rested for them on winning this game. When we went into the ground, and I'll just show you as well, I have the official replay programme here, Chelsea Leeds, with this is Old Trafford on the background. And in the centre pages, we have the two teams. And in the bottom, a little note, if this game goes to a replay, it will be at Coventry City's ground the following Saturday at 7:30. Now, why Coventry, why Highfield Road was chosen for an FA Cup final possible, I have no idea. Even in those days, Highfield Road would have only taken about 35,000, 36,000. So why wouldn't we Villa Park? And obviously, Guy, you know the Midlands area really well. Villa Park to me seemed the more natural choice, but there we go. When we got into the ground, now, my ticket cost me 12 and 6 in old currency. In new currency, in today's currency, that's about 60 pence, which really think what value that is for an FA Cup final, you know, 60 pence to watch an FA Cup final. My ticket says groundside Stretford End, because at the time, I always thought the Stretford End was just one long terrace, but it wasn't. Half of it was a terrace, and behind it was a seating area, which very few people seem to know about. It comes a bit of a shock to me as well. But when I got in there, I'd been to Old Trafford for the 1968 Everton Leeds FA Cup semi-final, and the Everton fans had been given the Stretford End. And I knew straight away, in terms of giving your team an advantage, having the Stretford End for your support was a massive boost for Chelsea, because the Leeds fans were in the old scoreboard end, which was open-ended, so they just couldn't generate anything like the same level of noise. So the atmosphere there was brilliant. I was mega, mega impressed. And the Chelsea support all the way through the game was non-stop. And the atmosphere, you know, it was my first FA Cup final that I've been to. So it was just a great experience as well for me. And so definitely having the Stretford End was a massive advantage for the Chelsea support. And in some ways, the atmosphere was better there than at Wembley, because the fans were closest to the action. Because at Wembley, you know, if you're behind the goals, you were miles from the action. So it felt like, it almost felt like a league game, but it was an FA Cup final. But there were 63,000 there as well, I think, which was pretty close to United's capacity. And I remember when we're walking around the ground that for some reason, I think lots of people had bought tickets and then found out they couldn't come to the replay for various work commitments and things. And I came across the strange sight of a policeman outside the ground with a wad of tickets in his hand, saying to people, anyone need a ticket? Anyone need a ticket? I've been given all these tickets, I can't get rid of them. So it was quite a bizarre experience from that point of view as well. But yeah, I was glad I was there to witness it because the atmosphere, the memories of the whole experience of staying with me for, you know, almost half a century now, to quote you, Sue.
Like you say, depending on what we're trying to say there, half a century is either a modern final or half a century is a lifetime ago. I feel like Rob Conroy might have been a bad influence on you, Paul, or you were a bad influence on Rob Conroy. Either way, I'm not sure how much, as a teacher, I'm not sure I can condone some of the action from you two boys.
About Rob Conway, I mean, bizarrely enough, when we went to that Burnley replay game I mentioned before, when it got to the end of our fifth year, Rob left school, went to a tech college that I stayed on for sixth form, and we lost touch. We'd not seen each other since 1971. When that Burnley article went on These Football Times, one of my old school friends got a twisted. Let you know, Paul, my wife is in touch with Rob's ex-wife. She's told him about the article. He'd love to meet up again. So we actually arranged to meet up a year ago Christmas in Liverpool. I haven't seen him for 50 years. And first thing he brought out with him, and you'll love this guy, he says, I've got my autograph book here, Paul. Do you know who's the first name is? I got it straight away, yeah. Alan Hudson, isn't it? Yeah, it's Alan Hudson's autograph. And we've kept in touch since then. So it's been, you know, just shows the power of These Football Times. That suddenly, people you haven't known for 50 years, you're back in touch with again.
That's brilliant. That's almost better than the story of this replay. I love stuff like that. it's thrown me off what I was going to ask Aidan. So you seem to be copping for the sort of the contemporary questions to this final, Aidan. I apologise for this one as well. But Paul makes a great point there about finals being played at league grounds where, you know, action is so much closer to the pitch. We've talked about the old Wembley on numerous podcasts, and yes, it had its place. You know, we had the dog track round the outside, and everyone seems so far away. You know, other countries don't have national stadiums, or certainly don't have national stadiums as was, you know, the old Wembley. I don't want to get into the discussion of is there a need for a national stadium, because obviously Wembley's been redesigned now, so it's different. But in terms of that atmosphere that Paul talked about, you know, the ability that a league ground has to generate atmosphere compared to a neutral national stadium, do you think there's anything in that?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you can build it out to look at stadiums in the likes of Italy with running tracks around them. And then you look at Juventus, who have a new stadium now, which is the total opposite of that, with the crowd close in. That's the same concept, isn't it? It's getting things close to the action. It's getting the fans on top of the action. In this particular game, you know, everyone was so close that they nearly ended up with players landing on top of them from various incidents. What Paul's talking there about the atmosphere is great, because that came across just watching highlights of this last night in preparation for this, of just how sort of raucous it was, the energy, I think, from the crowd. And that's something that gets lost at the old Wembley, and it gets lost at the new Wembley for different reasons, I think. But at the old Wembley, it got lost because it was too expansive. It was it wasn't sort of steep. You know, steep bankings of crowds and stands always, it makes it feel a little more enclosed, a little more intimidating. And acoustically, I imagine that also helps keep the noise in. Yeah. Whereas Wembley, it just escapes into the ether, doesn't it? And it's just lost. So, yeah, very much so. I mean, for a cup final to be played out in a stadium like that, which, you know, in those days, a lot of it would be terracing rather than seating, I guess. But it just lent a great atmosphere for what was always going to be a highly charged game, given the way it had gone in the first game and the animosity that the guys have already mentioned, the history between the two. It was always going to be lively no matter what, but putting it in that kind of atmosphere where, rather than when it's at Stamford Bridge or Elland Road, where, you know, the odds are skewed in terms of the crowd very much in one side's favour or the other, this was more even. Yes, one team had the Stretford end and the other team had the other end. But, you know, overall, I guess the numbers were relatively even. And so the noise will have been fever pitch, I guess, you know, shouting each other down. And that will have just enhanced this occasion tenfold, I'm quite sure, in a way that Wembley just could never have hoped to do.
Yeah, I get it. And to me, I as we know, I've never played professional football in my life, but that almost claustrophobic atmosphere, Aidan, you know, as a player, must be something, unless you're on the end of a lot of verbal abuse, I get, but as a player, to play in that intense claustrophobic environment must be so almost energizing or enhance the senses than playing, like you say, in those open expanse with the running track, you know, and everything is just almost so remote. But to them playing where, like you say, where players practically end up on the knees of the front row, if you like, it, you know, as a player, it must heighten the senses as well as for the fans as well.
The difference of being able to hear the comments directed at you, you know, the overall shouts and so on, you know, I'm sure that just blends into a background blur of noise. But I'm sure players close to the edges when various things were going on could hear individual comments or several comments aimed at them. But equally, just being close to the crowd will have given them an extra kick, an extra spur when energy was starting to sap or, you know, to go after the guy that they really needed to go after, as was the case here. A little bit of an extra boost to get it done because they knew the guy in row B just over there had told him to pull his finger out and get on with it. And, you know, it doesn't want to run past him again, having disappointed him.
You can tell we obviously clearly work too much together. My next question was for you, Gary, is, you know, we're going to get into the game next. We're going to get into the game next with Paul. But, you know, does the location of this final almost set the tempo for what's about to unfold over the next 120 minutes?
Probably, as the guys have mentioned, that, you know, the at Old Trafford, it's a different stadium to Wembley. It's not a showpiece. It's more like a domestic game. And you know, the animosity that Chelsea and Leeds and brought into the Wembley final would have been intensified by the Wembley final, and dropped into Old Trafford, which is a very atmospheric stadium anyway, just ratcheted up another notch or 17, and. You know, there was lots of, what's the word I'm looking for? Physically, almost over-physical challenges going in to prove a point, to establish that, you know, neither team was going to be bullied by the other. And, you know, I don't want to sort of, you know, get into the game with Paul in a second, but the game was like a powder keg. And like the blue touch paper. There were plenty of fireworks afterwards.
and I mean, you know, I guess, Paul, you know, we come to sort of the crux of the matter. And, you know, obviously the game, you know, the highlights have been shown, you know, the goals have been shown. You know, that I'm not saying the story of the game is so well known, but it's everything around this final. It's certainly everything around this replay that we've talked about so far that's just as important that puts it in its context. But, you know, if you can sort of talk us through the game, but obviously the arguably the probably the most damning statistic or most enlightening statistic is this game only generates one booking. So before you sort of talk us through the incidents, people just need to bear in mind there is only one yellow card shown in this entire game. And you were there. So you will have seen firsthand how this game played out and there was only one booking.
Well, I think you have to judge it by the standards of the time as well, Stu, because looking back retrospectively, you know, I can see why people formed the view that was an absolute bloodbath. But at the time, you know, 60s going into the 70s, you'd had the Man United Studiantes game, which was, you know, savage on the park. You'd had the 66 World Cup, where the best players had been kicked out by savage tackling. You'd had the Battle of Santiago in 62 between Chile and Italy. You had the Battle of Goodison Park between Everton and Leeds in 1964. So these sorts of, you know, rocks on football pitches were not unusual for the time. In fact, you know, quite often if you went to a game, if you didn't see a rock, you'd be quite disappointed that you hadn't got your money's worth. It was part of the match day experience. I think going into the game as well, for Leeds United, this was their last chance of salvaging anything from the game, because they'd lost the European Cup semi, they'd lost the league title. And for Chelsea as well, it was a chance to prove that they were the side on the rise. They'd been in the cup final 3 years before and underperformed against Tottenham. And so for both sides, it was a lot at stake as well. And of course, in those days, the cup final was the last game of the season. And this one had been extended because of the replay. So there was everything to play for. Looking back at the game now, when you're there and you come home and then you watch the highlights a long time afterwards, you have two different experiences to try and marry together. When I was at the game, I didn't think it was a particularly dirty game. The first challenge that stood out for me, because we were in the Stretford ends, was when Mick Jones clashed into Peter Benesi. And it was an awful challenge. Benesi, I don't think, was fully fit for the rest of that game. He was down on the floor about 4, 5, 6 minutes. At that time, there's only one substitute allowed. I think Marvin Hinton was the Chelsea substitute. So the referee gave Chelsea as much time as possible for Benesi to get back on his feet. But the consequence of that was Benesi couldn't take goal kicks for the rest of the game. I think one of the defenders took the goal kick. So that kind of soured things in the Chelsea fans' mind for the start, because you're a Chelsea fan, you go with the idea of these dirty Northerners and look at the trial goalkeeper, and that just increased the level of frenzy and antipathy even more. And then within about 7 minutes of that, Leeds scored a brilliant goal. I mean, the move from Clark, where he almost slaughters past three or four Chelsea defenders, the pass through to Mick Jones, he beats another two and whacks it in from the edge of the box. And even a fully fit Benesi would not got anywhere near that. So that was just a brilliant goal. My memories of the first half are, apart from Chopper Havers taking out Eddie Gray, which you knew was going to happen, that was no surprise to anybody who turned up the final. The way Eddie Gray tormented David Gray at Wembley, just knew that Chopper Havers was going to do it. I'm sure Leeds were prepared for that as well. So the first half was just, to me, a really entertaining game. Second half, I think these are the better team in the first half as well. But it was end-to-end. Second half, Chelsea were getting more and more back into the game. And I mentioned before about the level of support for Chelsea. The noise their fans were generating to get the side back into the game, it was just ear-piercing. And at times, there was just constant chants of Chelsea, and they kept it going for 55, 60 chants. And you can see the team were getting visibly lifted by this. And then the equaliser came from Charlie Cook, a brilliant cross that Peter Osgood then met to equalise the game 12 minutes from time. That meant Osgood scored every round as well, I think. And I think as well, there were by this stage a few things starting to go on around the pitch. Jack Charlton infamously said afterwards that the reason why Osgood was left unmarked to score, which is so uncharacteristic for his defence at that time, was that he'd gone looking for Ian Hutchison to seek retribution for Hutchison having put a tackle on him as well. And during the game, there were little things. I mean, Chelsea, Gary may not agree with this, but Chelsea targeted Billy Bremner all the way through the match. The number of times Billy Bremner ended up on the floor was incredible. And if you see the tackle in the second half when Eddie McCready almost kicks Billy Bremner's head off in the penalty area, and the referee really play on. It's just it's a red card, it's a penalty. There's no way you can say it wasn't. But for both teams, there were all these incidents going on alongside the football. And that's what makes such a compelling game, because it wasn't just about skill. It wasn't just about savagery. It was about a player who 1 minute could be kicking someone in the backside or kicking them in the ankle, and the next minute be waltzing around four players and producing a 40-yard stupendous pass or chip on a muddy pitch. So it was just that right combination of soccer savagery and soccer finesse. And looking back at it now, you just have to totally admire the levels of skill of those players to keep that level of intensity going for 120 minutes. And there were lots of things going on. And you can concentrate on the fact that maybe the referee let Massa get out of hand. I think in the referee's defence, I believe that was his last game he was going to referee. And I think as well, no one had been sent off in an FA Cup final before, and he didn't want to be the referee to send somebody off in an FA Cup final. So I think the referee was determined to try and let things flow as best he could until it maybe got to the stage where he had to take some action. Yeah, it's bizarre that only Hutchison got booked, as for the players who could have been booked in the game. And I know David Ellery subsequently refereed the game and said he'd given 6 red cards and 22 yellows or something daft like that. But this is David Derby, a public schoolmaster from Harrow, you know, who isn't quite used to real life interaction between footballers. The same man has sent Duncan Ferguson off using industrial language in a match. So I take no store by what David Derby has to say about the final whatsoever. So judged by the standards of its time, it was not unusual. I think the first half, there were relatively few instances, few more in the second half, where you could say it got a bit out of hand was in extra time. But, you know, hey, it's last game of the season. It's extra time. Both sides are going for it. I mean, what was great about it was, you know, there were no players roaming around on the ground demanding that the referee boot somebody. There's nobody lying there in agony. It was just, like, I've chopped you. You've chopped me. Get back on with the game. And when it got to extra time, and so, boring fact this, but when the game was 0-0 after 90 minutes, and on that same evening, Manchester City won the European Cup Winners' Cup, it meant that for the next 30 minutes, Manchester City were holders of the League Cup, the FA Cup, and the European Cup Winners' Cup simultaneously for 30 minutes. I don't think any team's ever done that before. But going back to extra time, I meant about the Chelsea supporters. When Chelsea got the throw-in, and you forget, I mean, long throw-ins, apart from Rooney's, have happened in recent times, have really been underestimated in terms of their potency. Ian Hutchinson, the length and depth he could get on a throw-in was absolutely incredible. And when Chelsea got the throw-in, the chance of Chelsea, it was just about a 30-time chance, I think, when Hutchinson took the throw-in. And when you see it, the loop on it, the heist, caused pandemonium in the Leeds defence. And then eventually, David Webb, who had an actually awful time in the Bristol Cup final, bundles the ball over the line for what proves to be the winning goal. And when I was in the Stretford end, it was just absolutely bedlam. I think my mate Rob was up on one of the crash barriers, jumping on top of everybody. How we didn't get split up, I don't know. But it was just absolutely brilliant. So, I mean, you know, it's like everything else. You can take a negative view of things or a positive view of things. To me, that was just a classic FA Cup final for all the right reasons. And, you know, a modern day fan might think, oh, that was awful, those tackles were terrible. But that was the game then. You know, you have to survive those type of tackles from behind, over the top, routinely, to be able to carry on and play football. And, you know, I mean, I outlined the start of the reason why I thought that was a great final. I was saying the quality of the football played in that final is underestimated, because there were some lovely touches from all the players throughout the 120 minutes. And given the fact that it was the last game of the season as well, and the players on their absolute legs, you know, it's a credit to the side that they kept going like that. And although the referee's been kind of, you know, criticised subsequently, you know, if you're a referee in that game, it's the last game in your career. Do you really want to be remembered as the guy sense off the first play in FA Cup final, do you? So I can't fully understand where he was coming from.
Yeah, what I was going to say was, Paul, you know, as you mentioned there, arguably you have to give the referee a lot of credit. You know, you've talked about this being an iconic game. You've talked about, you know, the moments in it. You know, he doesn't want to be the first referee to send a player off, and rightly so. But if a player deserves to be sent off, he should be sent off. But really, the reason why we're talking about this game, why it's so iconic, is actually down to the referee partly and his handling of the game.
Yeah, undoubtedly too, because it would have been quite easy for the referee to take quite an officious attitude towards it. But I think as well, trying to give the referee a bit of a retrospective credit here, and I'm trying to read his mind to some extent, but he might be concerned that if he'd sent somebody off, he might not have gone off. It might be like a ratting type situation where he was surrounded by the players of both sides and refusing to go off. He might have also been concerned that would he be inflaming the situation by sending somebody off? Because, you know, let's put it this way, if a Chelsea player being sent off, then Chelsea are going to try and get a Leeds player sent off in retaliation and vice versa. So maybe he made a judgment for the general benefits of football that, look, you know, it's extra time. I'm going to be a bit more leaning to it. It's a good game. I'm enjoying refereeing it. As long as nobody headbutts somebody right in front of me, I'm just going to let it flow.
Aidan, do you think that, I suppose, what, you know, I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but do you think, because, you know, the football that was played, and certainly, you know, Luke Jones' first goal for Leeds, it's a beautiful goal. You know, it absolutely is. And like we said, the horror and the beauty, do you think it's why it's, I don't say it's so well remembered, but when you see such horrific challenges, and you know, although Paul's put it in its context, you see such horrific challenges, but you also see such beautiful football. They almost accentuate and highlight each other.
yeah, I think they do, particularly in this game, and that's why it's iconic, as Paul was saying. You know, this game would not be so iconic without the violence that went on. I still don't quite get, no matter if it was your final match in charge, how a flying kick to somebody's head isn't a red card. I don't get that. But, you know, I've seen red comments from some of the players involved who were saying that the referee was just saying to them after every single incident, just get up and get on with it, lads. And, you know, I think the players were happy with that. I don't think they had any complaints, really, because it was the same for them both. But it was strange still in some of these cases, very strange. But having said all that, yes, this game would not have been the same without it. The skill on show was very impressive. The opening goal, as you said, was really, really good. In contrast to the opening goals in the first final, which were poor defensively, in this game, the quality was showing through in spite of it all. Marginally better surface than the first game, perhaps, but you know, that's marginal. It was still a mud bath. It still wasn't great. But to as Paul was saying there, to be able to do all of this with all that chaos going on around them, did that spur them on to greater performances? Possibly, you know, because this was a side of both teams. This wasn't the slick glamour against the dour cloggers from the north. You know, this was two teams that were actually quite alike in many ways. And I know Gary's talked with his snake analogy of the different styles for attack, but in many ways they had a lot of similarities, probably more similar to each other than either would care to admit in many ways. And therefore, they were just going at it hammer and tongs with each other, both giving as good as they could get. You know, the roughhousing, the violence, if you want to call it that, the terrible tackles in some cases went hand in hand with the great play. It simply wouldn't have been as iconic without it. It's as simple as that. So given what the referee did, I doubt we'd have been talking about the game today if he hadn't let it go like that. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I suppose one of the points to consider as well, Gary, you know, in amongst all this, and Aidan kind of touched on it there as well, and that's, you know, these moments of great skill, you know, and a real genuine football talent, and, you know, some world-class talent out there amongst those 22. And that's the state of the pitch. You know, and the ball that's being used, you know, this game isn't played out on the carpets in the Premier League that we see now, you know. And I think, again, Paul mentioned that, you know, in terms of the length and duration and the brutality of the season, the lack of substitutes, you know, the fact that this game is produced at the end of a season, it's produced, you know, when, you know, both sides have finished second and third. So there's that heartache and disappointment at losing out on the league. Leeds United, as we say, you know, lose out in the European Cup semi-final. You know, there's a lot of heartache and a lot of effort gone into, you know, both teams have gone, well, certainly Leeds have gone a long way in two cup competitions. They've come close in the league and they're playing on atrocious pitches, and yet they're still producing, you know, some quite glorious football on the most horrific of surfaces.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of occasions in the game that sort of emphasised how important not losing was to both sides. I mean, when Benetti was on the floor, the injury that Paul mentioned earlier, when Mick Jones bundled him into the net, shall we say, in inverted commas. Jackie Charlton took the opportunity to first knee Peter Osgood and then headbutt him while Benetti was on the floor and the referee's attention was elsewhere, shall we say. But yeah, there was and tactically as well, there's a couple of astute changes that Chelsea made that made a big difference. In the first game at Wembley, David Webb was played as a fullback and Ron Harris played in the centre of defence, and Eddie Gray just destroyed David Webb. You know, a decent defender, but you know, Eddie Gray was in his pomp. And in the replay, Sexton swapped the players over, and Ron Harris welcomed Eddie Gray to the game in the traditional manner, shall we say, and was less of a factor afterwards. And David Webb was much more comfortable playing in the centre of the defence. But there was some really good play in the games, and the first two goals, the guys have mentioned about Mick Jones's goal It was took his goal well. Great opening created by the Leeds players. The equaliser, Osgood's equaliser, which is about a dozen minutes or so from the end. Charlie Cook was playing in midfield rather than on the wing, and he beat two or three players and put this beautiful cross. But I say cross, it was more like a forward pass into the area, and Osgood scored with a diving header, picked the ball, and Revy had decided to change the goalkeepers, and Sprake had played in the first game in the Wembley, but he had been replaced by David Harvey for the replay, and it was a great goal, two great goals that sort of transcended the occasion and the brutality of the game and the pitch that they were playing on. I wrote an article about the game a while ago, and it was sort of nicking a line from Shakespeare. It was cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. And it was that sort of a game. But interspersed between that brutality was some wonderful episodes of talent and skill, much unsuited to the surface they were playing on.
I love the idea of inserting Shakespeare quotes into this podcast, guy.
I've got a title. Just go to Shakespeare.
Yeah, no, it's quite the bar you've set. I really have to ask the question. I'm just looking at Aidan there. I'm wondering what Shakespeare has got in his locker for his last question.
I'm in trouble here.
Yeah. I don't think that's what I'm... so, obviously, you know, the game's over, and unfortunately, you know, we're sort of coming to the end of what has been, again, another brilliant episode. Obviously, you know, Leeds go on and win more under Revy. Chelsea, maybe not so much as Gary alluded to it at the beginning, but obviously Chelsea then come good in the sort of the new millennium, if you like. But in terms of sort of post-1970 FA Cup final replay, are both teams at their zenith, if you like, at their peak? Or, you know, does it still get better for Leeds? You know, do Chelsea fade slowly? Is it a dramatic fall? You know, where does it go from sort of this April evening in 1970?
Well, I mean, both teams the following season go on to European success. I mean, Chelsea go on to win the European Cup, Winners' Cup. Leeds go on to win the Intercity's first cup. I think that's the last version of it. But I think from that subsequent season onwards, the two clubs start to go in different directions. I think Leeds get stronger and stronger. You get the side from 73-74, who go like 29 games unbeaten from the start of the season with the league title in Revy's last season. 1975, Leeds United playing in the European Cup final against Bayern Munich. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, Gary. Did Chelsea go down in 75? Yeah, so you, So you just see how actually you could argue that for that Chelsea team, they had 12 months more left in them, and the relationship between the manager and the players, in particular, more maverick, skillful players, starts to go downhill quite rapidly. And then with the Leeds side, they actually, Leeds got a lot of criticism in the 60s and 70s. Now, it's debatable whether that was fair or unfair. But one thing you cannot knock Leeds for is their resilience. Any side that had blown three trophies in one season to come back and re-establish themselves as league champions, that takes a huge effort as well. And if, just say, go off tangent slightly here. We talked about Peter Houseman there before, about what a good goal he had in Chelsea's cup run. I think he scored 5 goals in the cup run as well. He died when he was 33 in a car crash in the 70s after he moved to Oxford United. He was in the car with his wife and a friend and his wife. All four of them died in the car crash. They were crashed into by a Maserati car doing 100 miles an hour on the wrong side of the road in Oxfordshire, driven by the son of a former Conservative MP. It left 6 kids without any parents. The driver got like a suspended sentence and a ban from driving. Absolutely outrageous. And, it was such a terrible end to somebody's life. So I want to mention Peter Houseman there because he often goes under the radar in terms of Chelsea stars and Chelsea achievements.
It's not for many Chelsea fans, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's a great point, and Peter Houseman is well respected among Chelsea fans.
I'm glad to hear that, Gary.
Yeah.
It's, like I say, Aidan, I think unfortunately, you know, you seem to be getting the contemporary questions, but you know, in terms of, but I am waiting for a Shakespeare quote that you're going to throw into this answer. But in terms of the FA Cup final, like I said, you know, it's things we've talked about, but it's almost now it's almost lost to a generation. You know, I teach sort of 16, 18-year-olds, you know, and the FA Cup final, it's just lost. It's almost a lost competition now. Amongst that generation, it's Premier League, it's Champions League, or it's nothing, you know. And yet, there's so much to love, and so much not necessarily, maybe not to learn per se, but there's so much to be admired, there's so much to read, there's so much to learn, so much to enjoy from the tournament. And this game, I guess, kind of, as we said right at the beginning, you know, this game is a time-stamped, iconic FA Cup final.
Alas, poor FA Cup, we knew you well.
Oh, my word.
Brilliant.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
No, I was too busy thinking of that and I missed most of the question, but I'll do my best. But you're right. It's perceived so utterly differently. This is something we've talked about on various pods over the years about the FA Cup and what it means or doesn't mean nowadays, and it's a shame in so many ways. I mean, all of us grew up with the FA Cup final being the biggest biggest football event of the year, the biggest TV event as well. You know, it was a full day of excitement. That just isn't the case for people now. And, you know, I get the reason for it. Premier League has become so all-encompassing, the be-all and end-all. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a trophy. And what is football about? And that's striving for glory. You know, not everyone can achieve it, but you can try. I'm starting to end into a Newcastle rant here for a moment, but you know, that's the same kind of thing I say whenever I talk about Newcastle. But at the end of the day, it's a competition to win. There are only three competitions domestically to win any given year. And to sort of devalue two of them because they don't happen to be the Premier League seems, it's disappointing. It's a shame. I'm not saying they're necessarily devalued by the teams who end up winning them, but the occasion is devalued, shall we say. And I don't see any way of that reversing at all. You know, certain things, as we've discussed in the past, can be done to maybe, I don't know, increase the appeal throughout the competition. But when it comes to cup final day, it will never be like it was because football is saturation coverage now. You know, it's everywhere, and even more so in our current situation because every game is live somewhere or other, seemingly. And there's so many other options for football from all over the world. You can pick and choose whatever you like. TV viewership, numbers wise, is nothing like what the guys were mentioning here. 28 million people watching an FA Cup final replay. You know, a cup final replay, or not a replay now, of course, a cup final now could be the best game you could ever imagine, but it would never get a fraction of that audience because there's so many other options. When it comes to watching football on TV, most Premier League games get really, really small audience because people can pick and choose the ones they want to watch. Nobody's going to collectively watch one game because it doesn't interest them. It doesn't appeal because there's so many other games on that you're only going to pick the ones that are of relevance or interest to you. And therefore, the whole shared experience that the cup final was, and other big games too, is gone. It's gone forever. The only way that you can get close to that now would be a World Cup, I would guess, where you have that whole shared experience that the whole country or many countries in that case is enjoying together. I don't think even a Champions League final gets there. I think far more neutrals would be engaged in the Champions League final, but it doesn't quite hit the heights of what the FA Cup final used to be and what a World Cup hopefully still can be. FA Cup, unfortunately, the days of that being the biggest football event in the calendar are gone. And it's a shame because it was a big part of my youth, a big part of all of your youth as well, I'm sure. But yeah, those days are gone, just like the replays. Alas, there's another one for you.
I think it was, I think it was Steve Bruce. I remember an interview, and you know, they were talking about the FA Cup, and you know, and he was saying that, you know, if a professional's had, you know, a 12-year career in the game, they've done really well. He said, but that equates to you only ever get 12 opportunities to win the FA Cup. And that's it. That's all you get as a professional footballer. You know, and he said to throw them away or to not, you know, not to fully commit to the competition. It was a really good interview that he did. And I can remember that standing out, you know, 12 opportunities that's all most players will ever get. And that might be even more than most will get.
It's a shame he doesn't try as a manager, but that's a whole lot.
He gets loads of attempts as a manager. He just doesn't want to win it up in Newcastle, that's all. Gary, I am going to ask you all for your sort of favourite moment before we go, guys. But for you, Gary, you know, as a Chelsea fan, I guess the question here is where does this final sit with you as a Chelsea fan in terms of the lifetime of big games as a Chelsea fan?
That's a good question, Stu. I'm going to sort of reach out to the board, and if you know, if the FA Cup be the food of love, then by all, give me access of it. I mean, this FA Cup final triumph was the first trophy Chelsea won in my lifetime. As I say, we won the league title the year before I was born. Typical Chelsea. Typical blooming Chelsea. I have to wait 50 years for another one. But, you know, this was the first trophy we won, so it'll always have a special place in my heart. I mean, you know, I won't pretend that it's sort of is more magnificent than the you know, winning the league title, winning the Champions League. But because it was the first title the first trophy that we lifted in my lifetime, it will always have a special place in my heart. And when David Webb scored that winning goal from Hutchinson long throw in and it bobbled in, it was the ugliest, most magnificent goal I remember from the time. And I remember getting up from this. I was watching the game at home. I might be 13 at the time with my mum and dad. And I remember getting up and kicking. I could kick the set. I don't know why, but I did. I remember my dad saying, "What are you doing?" I said, "We're going to win the FA Cup." And he said, "All right, then."
There you go.
Magic memories.
Seti kicking worthy. That'll do for me. That'll do for me as
magic memories.
As a bar.
Well, thanks, Paul, for picking this cup final, mate, for me.
I've enjoyed it, Gary. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Before we go then, guys, you know, there's a lot of moments in this game. A lot of moments. Aidan, I'll give you first pick on this one. In terms of your sort of standout moment, you know, be it skill, brutality, memorable, sums up, you know, if you had your moment from this replay, what would you pick?
Wow, there are a lot to choose from.
There are.
But I think I'll go for one that Gary mentioned earlier, which was right at the start when Eddie Gray got poleaxed by Chopper Harris. That set the tone. That was this game in a nutshell. That started it off. I mean, you know, someone else would have started off if he hadn't, frankly. it's not to blame him at all. But given the way Eddie Gray had played in the first game, you know, his creative skills on the wing, he was leaving people falling on their backsides all over the place at Wembley. So yes, something needed to be done about him. Whether this was the right thing or not is another matter, but it was certainly dramatic and it certainly set the tone. So I'll go for that one.
Brilliant. I'll leave you to last, Gary, because you normally pick two, to be fair. And I'm pretty sure as it's a Chelsea win, there'll definitely be two. Paul, for you, I mean, you were there, so you might have seen things that we haven't seen via the television. But for you, your standout memory or moment from this game?
Well, if I just have a slight issue. So when the game had finished, it says again back to Liverpool, because the game had finished about 10:30. So we ended up getting the train back into Manchester Centre, where we actually bought the Manchester Evening News special edition to commemorate Man City with the European Cup winners. We haven't realised they'd won it that evening. And then we were there at Manchester Centre about 11:15. Loads of Chelsea fans have been around as well, trying to work out how to get back to London also. And we weren't quite sure how we'd get back to Liverpool. We were both like 13, we were both 14 at the time. So we started hitching at Manchester City Centre at 11:30 on a Wednesday evening. Car pulls up, guy picks us up, and he's going straight back to Liverpool City Centre, which is just brilliant. And he's chatting to the football great guy. Drops off in Liverpool, and then we started walking home. By this time, it's about 2 a.m. Now, of course, we have bags with us, all the programs and Rosetta's souvenirs. And next thing, police car pulls over, screeches to, "Hey, lads, what are you doing there? What have you got in those bags?" Right, up against the wall. So we're up against the wall. He's the open up. "What's this program? You've left these in the final." And they were really intrigued by the fact we'd come back from the FA Cup finals and suddenly went from being like potential suspect burglars to, "Okay, lads." So then they said, "Right, okay, we'll give you a lift back home then." So they started to drive us back home. Unfortunately, they changed about a mile and they got a call to go somewhere else. So then we had to get out of the car again and walk the rest of the journey home. But so it was quite an event to get back home after that. And I had a paper out the next morning at 7:30 as well. So I didn't have the best night's sleep. But in terms of a memory of the game, I'd find it really hard to pick out one memory. I mean, my overriding memory of the game is the noise being generated by the Chelsea fans on the Stretford End, because I'd never quite come across that level of noise at that type of occasion. So I think that would be my standout memory. But also, I think as well, my standout player from the game would be possibly Peter Benetti, because how he survived that challenge from Mick Jones and how he then went on to produce a number of potentially match-winning saves, I just don't know. But I think, you know, from my perspective, I think I said this at the start, it was a classic football match. It was skill, it was savagery, there were tackles flying in, there were brilliant passes being made, no one was diving, nobody was rolling around, no one was appealing to the referee. It was just a high standard of non-stop competitive football for 120 minutes. And I've got to be honest, I miss that type of football. And, you know, if I try to throw Shakespeare's quote in here, "All the world's a stage and the men are in many places."
Oh, I can't believe all of you have got Shakespeare. I'm so proud of everyone. I have nothing. Gary, for you, you know, you're left with 101 probably moments to choose from this game.
You know me so well, Stu, that I'm going to cheat and claim to.
Yeah.
and you know, I hope I'm not going to make myself look a twerp here. I think it's from The Merchant of Venice. And this phrase is, "All that glisters is not gold." But when Peter Osgood dived in that diving header, he had a yellow number 9 on the back of his shirt. I think it wasn't gold, but it was yellow. But it was a golden moment when he headed that ball past the Leeds goalkeeper to equalise. And I couldn't see us losing from there. And then at the end, when Chopper Harris picked that FA Cup up, the first trophy we'd won in my lifetime, it wasn't gold. It was silver, but it was gold for me.
Brilliant. Like I said, guys, it's just as I knew it would be. It's been a wonderful, wonderful episode. Paul, you are by far the best storyteller I have ever had the pleasure to listen to in my life. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on.
But thanks to Gary for coming up with the series, and thanks to you, Stu, for inviting me to be on the scene. I've loved going back down memory lane. You know, as you can see, the memories of that day are still vivid in my memories, and I really enjoyed watching the highlights again today, just to remind myself of one or two things. But it's just great to, you know, to go back, because I think we're all products of our generation, aren't we? You're kind of remember games you grew up with, and certain games will stay with you until your 70s, 80s, and 90s. And this is one game, undoubtedly, I'll carry with me the rest of my life.
Brilliant. Aidan, obviously, thank you for stepping in while Stephen claims he's otherwise engaged, but we're not really sure what he's doing. enjoyed it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, like I said at the start, what an iconic game and what a great chat. And echo everything you said about Paul and his stories. I mean, that trip home alone was worth listening for. But I'll end with, "Parting is such sweet sorrow, Stu." Oh. And I'll exit pursued by a bear.
Gary, did you ever think it would become quite such a highbrow series when you came up with this?
No, of course not. I mean, it's been great, and, you know, massive, massive thanks to Paul for picking this one, because it was a great one for me to indulge in. And I also watched the highlights earlier in the game, and then I watched the full game again because I just wanted to. So thanks for that, Paul, allowing me, an old man, a little bit of pleasure. You make a young man, an old man, feel quite young again.
You've always been the youngest looking of us, Gary.
Oh, bless your cotton socks, boy. Bless your cotton socks.
guys, it, like I say, it's been absolutely brilliant. All that's left for me to say, you know, is if football be the food of love, then play on. Thank you ever so much for listening. Well and done. Please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.